And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is April the 24th, 114th day of the year. 251 days remain to the end of the year. Holidays and observances. Remember, y'all asked me to do this every morning. It's Scream Day, World Day for Animals and Laboratories, World Cities Day, National Skipping Day, National Administrative Professionals Day, International Day of Multilateralism and Diplomacy for Peace, Denim Day, Help Animals Day, International Guide Dog Day, National Pig in a Blanket Day, Stop Food Waste Day, Firefly Day, American Quilters Society Week, World Hula Week, National MS Week, National Stop Snoring Week, Administrative Professionals Week, Every Kid Healthy Week, National Volunteer Week, and Coin Week. Famous people born on this date: Kelly Clarkson, Barbara I'm Better Than You Streisand, and Kalani. April 24th is part of International Guitar Month, National Card and Letter Writing Month, National African American Women's Fitness Month, Child Abuse Prevention Month, Financial Literacy Month, Step Up for 30 for Bowel Cancer Month, Scottish American Heritage Month, National Humor Month, Global Volunteer Month, National Alcohol Awareness Month, National Soy Foods Month, National Food Month, National Month of Hope, National Soft Pretzel Month, Animal Cruelty Prevention Month, National Volunteer Month, National Kite Month, Sexual Assault Awareness Month, National Garden Month, National Poetry Month, Autism Acceptance Month, National Pickleball Month, Stress Awareness Month, Limb Loss and Limb Difference Awareness Month, National Jazz Appreciation Month, Poetic Earth Month, National Coupler Appreciation Month, Adoptive Ferret Month, Straw Hat Month, Month of the Military Child, Active Dog Month, Cemetery Changeover Month, National Decorating Month, and Parkinson Awareness Month. And let's see what we got. Okay, in 1479 BC, Thutmose III ascends to the throne of Egypt. Also, power effectively shifts to Hatshepsut, according to the low chronology of the 18th dynasty. She was the female pharaoh. 1183 BC, traditional reckoning of the fall of Troy, marking the end of the legendary Trojan War, given by the chief librarian of the Library of Alexandria, Eratosthenes, among others. 1547, Battle of Muhlberg, Duke of Alba, commanding Spanish imperial forces of Charles I of Spain, defeats the troops of Smalcaldic League. The Smalcaldic League was a military alliance of Lutheran princes within the Holy Roman Empire during the mid-16th century. Got its name from the town of Smalcalden, which is located in modern Thuringia. And in 1558, Mary, Queen of Scots, marries the Dauphin of France, Francois, at Notre Dame de Paris. 1704, first regular newspaper in British colonial America, the Boston Newsletter, is published. 1793, French revolutionary Jean-Paul Marat is acquitted by the Revolutionary Tribunal of charges brought by Girondin in Paris. 1800, U.S. and Library of Congress is established, and President John Adams signs legislation to appropriate $5,000 to purchase such books as may be necessary for the use of Congress. Most of them had pictures with big words. 1837, the Great Fire in Surat City of India caused more than 500 deaths and destruction of more than 9,000 houses. 1877, Russo-Turkish War. Russian Empire declares war on the Ottoman Empire. 1885, American sharpshooter Annie Oakley is hired by Nate Salsbury to be part of the Buffalo Bills Wild West show. 1895, Joshua Slocum, the first person to sail single handedly around the world, set sail from Boston aboard the sloop Spray. Then in 1913, the Woolworth Building, a skyscraper in New York City, is opened. Some happiest hours were in Woolworth's department store in the town I was born in. My mother had one of those harness deals that you put on children to keep them from wandering off. And I figured out how to get it open. And she was talking to somebody. And at the edge of this one counter was a post. Why? I don't know. So I took it off and I wrapped it around the post and fastened it. And I went off about my business. A few minutes later, I heard a big commotion and she was jerking on that post, won't know where the hell I'd gone. 1914, the Frank Hertz experiment, a pillar of quantum mechanics, is presented to the German Physical Society. 1915, the arrest of 250 Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Istanbul marks the beginning of the Armenian Genocide. 1916, Easter Rising. Irish rebels, led by Patrick Pearse and James Connolly, launch an uprising in Dublin against British rule and proclaim an Irish Republic. 1916, Ernest Shackleton and five men of the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition launch a lifeboat from an uninhabited Elephant Island in the Southern Ocean to organize a rescue for the crew of the sunken Endurance. 1918, World War I, first tank-to-tank combat during the Second Battle of Villers-Bretonneux. Three British Mark IVs meet three German A7Vs. 1922, the first segment of the Imperial Wireless Chain, providing wireless telegraphy between Leifland and Leafield in Oxfordshire, England, and Cairo in Egypt, comes into operation. The Imperial Wireless Chain, for those not familiar with it, was a strategic international communications network of powerful long-range radio telegraphy stations created by the British government to link the countries of the British Empire. Stations exchanged commercial and diplomatic text messages transmitted at high speed by Morse code using paper tape machines. The idea was first conceived prior to World War I, but the UK was the last of the world's great powers to implement a operational system. The first link in the chain, as I said, was Leafield in Oxfordshire and Cairo in Egypt. Eventually opened April 24th, 1922, with the final link between Australia and Canada opening in June 16th, 1928. Okay, 1924, Thorvald Stoning becomes Premier of Denmark. 1926, Treaty of Berlin is signed. Germany and Soviet Union each pledge neutrality in the event of an attack on the other by a third party for the next 5 years. 1932, Benny Rothman leads a mass trespass of Kinder Scout, leading to substantial legal reforms in the United Kingdom. 'The mass trespass of Kinder Scout' was a trespass protest at Kinder Scout in the Peak District in Derbyshire, England, in 1932. It sought to highlight that walkers were denied access to areas of open countryside which had been fenced off by wealthy landowners who forbid public access. Organized by communist leader and Jewish anti-fascist Benny Rothman, the secretary of the British Workers' Sports Federation, a member of the Young Communist League. They've always been anti-anything you can imagine. '33, Nazi Germany begins its persecution of Jehovah's Witnesses by shutting down the Watchtower Society office in Magdeburg. 1944, World War II. The SBS launches a raid against the garrison of Santorini in Greece. The SBS is the Special Boat Service, Special Forces unit of the UK's Royal Navy. And it was quite effective. 1953, Winston Churchill is knighted by Queen Elizabeth II. 1955, the Bandung Conference ends. 29 non-aligned nations of Asia and Africa finish a meeting that condemns colonialism, racism, and the Cold War. 1957, Suez Crisis. Suez Canal is reopened following the introduction of UNIF peacekeepers, that's the United Nations Expeditionary Force, to the region. 1963, the marriage of Princess Alexandra of Kent to Angus Ogilvy at Westminster Abbey in London took place on this date. 1965, Civil War breaks out in the Dominican Federal Republic when Colonel Francisco Camaño overthrows the triumvirate that had been in power since the coup d'etat against Juan Bosch. 1967, cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov dies in Soyuz 1 when its parachute fails to open. First human to die during a space mission. Now that's a first you don't want. 1967, Vietnam War. American General William Westmoreland says in a news conference that the enemy had gained support in the U.S. It gives him hope he can win politically, but that which he cannot win militarily. 1970, and it was the left that was actually responsible. But they never seemed to get it. 1970, China launches Dongfanghong-1, becoming the fifth nation to put an object into orbit using its own booster. Also in 1970, the Gambia becomes a republic within the Commonwealth of Nations with Dauda Jawara as its first president. 1979, Blair Peach, a British activist, died after being knocked unconscious during an anti-Nazi League demonstration outside against the National Front election meeting in Southall, London. It was actually Clement Blair Peach. I was 33 years old at the time of death. A New Zealand teacher killed during an anti-racism demonstration in Southall, London. A campaigner and activist against the far right took part in an anti-Nazi League demonstration in Southall against the National Front election meeting in the town hall and was hit on the head, probably by a member of the Special Patrol Group. It was a unit within the Metropolitan Police Service. He died in the hospital that night. 1980, 8 U.S. servicemen die in Operation Eagle Claw as they attempt to end the Iran hostage crisis. Operation Eagle Claw, for those who are not familiar, was a failed operation by the Armed Forces ordered by President Jimmy the Peanut Man Carter to attempt to rescue 52 embassy staff held captive at the embassy of the U.S. in Tehran in 1980. It was one of Delta Force's first missions. It encountered many obstacles and failures and was subsequently aborted. Carter later bragged he had personal command of that particular unit, which may be one reason it failed. 1980, STS-31, the Hubble Space Telescope, is launched from the Space Shuttle Discovery. 1990, Gwynard Island, Scotland, is officially declared free of the anthrax disease after 48 years of quarantine. 1993, an IRA bomb devastates the Bishopsgate area of London. 1994, Douglas DC-3 ditches in Botany Bay after takeoff from Sydney Airport. All 25 people on board survive. 1996, in the U.S., the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996 is passed into law. It was about broad bipartisan support by Congress in response to the bombings of the World Trade Center in Oklahoma City. Bill Clinton signed it into law. Controversial for its changes to the law of habeas corpus in the U.S., the bill contained a number of provisions to deter terrorism, provide justice for victims, provide for an effective death penalty, and other purposes. It was actually introduced by then-Senator Joe Biden. It'd be good for something. 2004, U.S. lifts economic sanctions imposed on Libya 18 years before as a reward for its cooperation in eliminating weapons of mass destruction. 2006, bombings in the Egyptian resort city of Dahab and killed 23 and injured about 80. 2005, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger is inaugurated as the 265th Pope of the Catholic Church, taking the name of Pope Benedict XVI. 2011, WikiLeaks starts publishing the Guantanamo Bay files leak. 2013, a building collapses near Dhaka in Bangladesh, killed 1,134 people and injured about 2,500 others. And in 2013, violence in Baca County, Kashgar Prefecture of China's Xinjiang, results in the death of 21 people. And that finishes a little history segment. Well, before we get into our main topic, I had somebody ask me the other day why I never talked about things that happened in the military. Because I spent, 17 years in the regular Army and the Reserves. And let me tell you, there were some strange things that happened there. My former wife had a bunch of friends she used to hang out with, and they wanted to do a canoe trip down the Chattahoochee River. And somebody said, well, you're military, won't you go with us? And my then wife was adamant that I had to go. Well, the canoes in the military that we had used had little keels on them, which was a rigid thing on the bottom, which gave it a little bit of stability. These canoes didn't. And I explained to everybody that canoes weren't the most stable boats in the world. They looked great in the movies, but you needed to be careful. Well, we're going along, and my then wife leaned over to point at something, and the canoe flipped, which, of course, upset her no end. It didn't do me any good. And getting in the canoe in the water is a difficult thing to do, but we got it accomplished. And there was another couple. Now, she was gorgeous, no question about it. But she's one of these people that had to have every hair in place. So she's sitting in front of the canoe, and they're alongside this little dock. And he came up, all excited about going, and literally jumped in the back of the canoe. And have you ever seen a slingshot? Well, that's how it looked when she went flying up in the air when the front of that canoe came up. And when she hit the water, excuse me, all you could hear was the scream, "My hair." It was interesting, let me tell you. And after we drug her out of the water, we had to separate him and her because she was going to take his head off. So it was the interesting beginning to a otherwise bizarre trip. Went back, a friend of mine was in the military with me. He knew I was an amateur treasure hunter. We used to go to areas that had the physical training test courses. Good Lord. We had to do all kinds of bizarre things. First time we went, I was didn't have hopes out for much, but soldiers carry money because there are food trucks that come by. So this Saturday we're out there, and from the time we hit the course until we left 2 hours later, we spent the whole time bent over because it was that much change buried in the ground. Now I'm talking about pennies and dimes and quarters and even some silver dollars in those days. I think I came up with about $60. He had probably as much. Metal detectors are enjoyable. You find some strange things, let me tell you. Well, we were talking yesterday about Jack the Ripper. You know, at that point in our law enforcement history, which was 1888, the concept of a serial killer really wasn't part of the language. Now, a couple of things that happened then that would happen today is the media would stir everybody into a frenzy, all in the name of getting a scoop. Now, forensic science, such as it was in those days, offering few clues as to the Ripper killers, or killer, fears of a killer on the roof or on the loose were stoked by a constant barrage of news stories, which detailed the ugliness, I guess you could say. As Whitechapel murders unfolded, the press in the United Kingdom and elsewhere knew the macabre story would draw in readers eager to learn the facts on the latest sensational case. In the decades before the Ripper murders, the number of UK newspapers had increased dramatically. More people could read and afford to buy papers, and they turned to them as a source of both news and entertainment. Well, during 1888, reports on the hunt for Jack the Ripper appeared in more than 300 newspapers around the world. London had more than a dozen major newspapers, both dailies and weeklies, that covered the killings in detail. And if they couldn't find the news, they'd make it up. While the information wasn't available as quickly as during today's 24/7 news cycle, reports sent by telegraph spread information on the Ripper murders within hours of the fact. Sensationalism that marked much of the reporting on the murders wasn't new from London papers. Modern scholars refer to it as murder news, and it was popular in the press for decades before Jack came along. And certain reporters specialized in the murder beat, as it was called. News reports on seemingly respectable men who killed were popular, especially if there was a sexual element to the story. The papers, while detailing gory details of a murder, usually expressed sexual elements of the tale in, I guess you could say, a more obscure way. Or, as with Jack's murder of Annie Chapman, the papers omitted some facts, such as the removal of her uterus. And in Victorian England, coverage of sensational topics could sometimes transcend the lurid and lead to social reform. In 1885, a pioneering investigative journalist named W.T. Stead published a series of articles called The Maiden Tribute of Modern Babylon, showed how easy it was for men to hire child prostitutes. His reporting led to a passage of a law that raised the age of sexual consent for girls from 13 to 16. As if those 3 years were going to make a major difference. Ripper reporting also had a social slant at times. Some newspapers highlighted the socio-economic conditions in the East End that seemed to be at the root of the destitution that marked Jack's victims. Reformers of the era used the press through letters to the editor to draw attention to possible remedies for these atrocious conditions. Alfred Hoare wrote to the Times in October of 1888 outlining the work of the Tenement Dwellings Company to improve housing in Whitechapel. Its goal was to buy houses, keep them in good repair, and lower the rents when possible. He hoped the end result would be to remove much of the squalor of the poorer quarters of London. Problem is, for every do-gooder, there are others who want to profit on that do-gooder. Newspapers reporting on the Ripper murders, though, often fuel the anti-Semitism already on the rise in the East End. Papers are quick to report accounts from witnesses that suggested suspects might be foreign. Term often associated with London's recent influx of Jewish immigrants. Other times, the papers were more direct, openly talking about Jewish suspects such as John Piser. Prejudice shown in the press led some rabbis and others in London's Jewish community to criticize the unfounded accusations. Keep in mind that stringers became reporters by reporting facts that no one else could get. Well, if you can't get it, make it up. Who's going to know you're lying? You know, certainly the extensive coverage by the media over more than 100 years has made much of the world familiar with Jack the Ripper and the details surrounding the case. Whitechapel murders constitute maybe the most notorious unsolved murders in recent times. But since Jack the Ripper roamed the streets of London, other cold case murders have also caught the public's attention. Maybe the best-known group of unsolved murders in the U.S. are the Zodiac killings. Now, from December 1968 through 1969, panic seized the people of Northern California. There was a killer stalking his prey, and he taunted the police and the public. As police investigated the murders, the killer began sending letters and cards detailing aspects of his crimes to the local newspapers. Often included a symbol indicating the sign of the Zodiac, leading those involved with the case to label him the Zodiac Killer. Included complicated ciphers or codes for investigators and ordinary citizens to try to decipher. The ciphers contained messages regarding the killer's motivation and intentions. And unfortunately, of the three ciphers he sent, only one has ever been decoded. Letters also included drawings and maps, and one letter included a piece of a victim's shirt, which seemed reminiscent of the piece of kidney sent to George Lusk with Jack's From Hell letter. After the murder spree, which included five confirmed victims, Zodiac also claimed to have committed an earlier murder that had been unsolved. And as with the Ripper murders, police had what they thought were several possible suspects, but nobody was ever convicted. Less famous stringer murders called the Kingsbury Run or the Torso Murders took place in Cleveland during the 30s. 12 people, both men and women, were killed and their bodies dismembered. In most cases, autopsies revealed the decapitation was the cause of death, and some victims had been drained of their blood. One had his heart ripped out, again echoing the progression of Jack the Ripper's butchery. Elliot Ness, who made his reputation hunting down bootleggers during Prohibition and whose work led to the downfall of Al Capone, investigated the murders and couldn't find any conclusive leads. 1939, an Ohio chef arrested Frank Dolezal for the first murder. Police custody, he suffered six broken ribs from being beaten, which may have led to the confession he gave. Dolezal hung himself in his cell before he could stand trial. So the Torso murders remain unsolved. Though at least one amateur sleuth believes the killer was a doctor named Francis Sweeney. And several well-known murder cases had just one victim, such as the Black Dahlia murder in Los Angeles in 1947. Naked body of aspiring actress Elizabeth Short is found in a vacant lot alongside a city sidewalk. Body been cut in half and drained of blood. Newspapers dubbed it a Black Dahlia because she is well known to dress in black, and a movie called The Blue Dahlia had come out the previous year. It was a film noir that featured a murder. The FBI was able to obtain fingerprints from an anonymous letter sent to police, but the prints didn't match any in the Bureau's files. 2017 book, Black Dahlia, Red Rose by Hugh Eatwell claims that the killer was Leslie Dillon, a Los Angeles bellhop. And one famous murder case that a lot of folks assumed was solved but wasn't was the 1892 axe murder of Andrew and Abby Borden. Andrew, a wealthy banker in Fall River, Massachusetts, was found on the first floor of his house. His wife's body was found upstairs. Andrew's daughter, Lizzie, stood trial for the murders but was found innocent. Nobody else was ever charged with the crime. Part of the reason cases like this are not solved is the police have a knee-jerk reaction. They go after the closest individual. If a husband is killed, they look at the wife. If the wife is killed, they look at the husband. In the case of Andrew and Abby Borden, they looked at their daughter. Now, what does this do? This gives the police tunnel vision. And, of course, a lot of cases are solved with what are known as gut reactions. And a policeman who comes up with the idea that it's so-and-so committed the murder is going to dismiss anything that seems to point away from the suspect. You know, even 25 years after the Whitechapel murders, metropolitan police officials continue to speculate about Jack the Ripper's identity. And it was a sign the police were not satisfied with the earlier theories about who Jack was. And every new procedure was applied to the case. In 1913, former Chief Inspector John Littlefield wrote a letter to a journalist named George Sims. Littlefield been working at Scotland Yard in 1888, though he wasn't on the Ripper case. In his letter to Sims, Littlefield said a likely suspect was Francis Tumbletty. He was a quack American doctor, and the inspector said Scotland Yard had collected information about him. And at the time of the murders, the police arrested Tumbletty for unnatural offenses, and Littlefield said his feelings toward women were remarkable and bitter in the extreme. But Tumbletty applied for and got bail, and then he skipped bail and fled to France and vanished. Well, the letter naming Tumbletty as a suspect wasn't made public till 1993, at which point the Ripperologist tried to piece together if he could have been Jack the Ripper. Now, he was born in Ireland, and then Tumbletty went to America as a boy, and as a young man claimed to be a doctor and sold various snake oil medicines. We got some folks that ought to be selling snake oil that I have to deal with. Had several scrapes with the law, and for a time was even accused of having ties to the plotters who assassinated Abraham Lincoln. But he managed to avoid long jail terms, and he was known to visit London. The unnatural offenses there most likely involved homosexual acts, as until 1967, homosexuality was a crime in England. He was arrested in London in November 1888 and fled shortly after that. And despite Littlefield's assertion that Tumbletty killed himself, he actually came back to the U.S. with several papers reported he was a suspect in the Whitechapel murders. New York City police even put him under surveillance, but they had no grounds to arrest him for the murders or even for having skipped bail in England. Eventually left the city and died in 1903 in Rochester, New York. Tumbletty was in London during the killings, and one man who claimed to know him said that Tumbletty had a collection of human wombs that he kept in glass jars. Still, a lot of Ripperologists are not convinced he was Jack. He was older than the man seen with the victims before their murders. 1888, Tumbletty was 55, also taller than those men. And while he was heard to speak harshly about women, he never displayed any violent tendencies. And additionally, shortly before Littlefield's letter was discovered, another candidate for Jack the Ripper emerged. In 1992, a British man named Michael Barrett said he was in possession of a diary that belonged to an English cotton merchant named James Maybrick. Like Tumbletty, Maybrick also had ties to the U.S., as his wife Florence was from Alabama. Well, the marriage soured, and while the couple was living in England in 1888, Florence began an affair. And then, add insult to injury, began to poison her husband. She was arrested the next year for his murder, and although convicted and sentenced to die, she eventually escaped execution, though she did serve 15 years in prison. Well, in the alleged James Maybrick diary, he confessed to killing the five prostitutes and claims he was motivated by rage after seeing his wife with her lover. The last entry came just a few days before Maybrick's death. It ended with the words, I give my name to all known to me. So, history do tell what love can do to gentlemen born. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Was Maybrick the Ripper? Well, since the publication of a book about the diary, experts have questioned whether it's authentic. The diary itself is from the Victorian era, but expert analysis of the ink hadn't conclusively proved it came from that time period. Handwriting does seem to match Known's examples of Maybrick's writing. And most damning of all, Michael Barrett once publicly claimed he'd forged the diary. Then he retracted the claim, and then again he said the diary was a forgery. Well, despite this inconclusive background, some people are still willing to accept that Maybrick was Jack the Ripper, even if the diary is fake. And of course, not everyone's convinced that it is. You know, not to be left out, even the FBI took a look at Jack. 1888, 100 years after the Whitechapel murders, an FBI agent prepared a report offering a profile of the kind of man Jack the Ripper was. Jack Douglas worked for the Bureau Center for Analysis of Violent Crime. And his report noted he used the medical and police reports available, though the information he had wasn't as thorough as what today's investigators would produce. That meant Douglas had to make certain probable assumptions to fill in the missing pieces. And some of the highlights of his deductions, the five initial killings were lust murders, which meant the killer focused on the victim's genitalia. There are also crimes of opportunity. Jack didn't stalk certain victims, but chose drunken prostitutes because they were easy targets. And the killer, a social loner, probably came from an unstable home and developed an internalized anger, which emerged in acts of violence. Probably lived in Whitechapel and worked at a job where he was often alone. And it's likely that at one point the police had questioned him, but he managed to avoid suspicion. And finally, according to Douglas, Jack would have believed his murders were justified. And Douglas does doubt that Jack committed suicide. He thinks he just quit killing and faded into the mist of time. You know, a name that's been associated with Whitechapel murders for decades is that of the artist Walter Sickert. Claims linking him to the Royal Conspiracy appeared during the 70s, and by the 1990s, a theory emerged that Sickert himself was Jack. That claim was the focus of two books by American mystery writer Patricia Cornwell, who spent many years and several million dollars to collect information she said proved Sickert was the killer. Born in 1860, he was a well-known painter and art critic in England during the early years of the 20th century. Some of his work hangs in London's Tate Gallery and influenced by American painter James Abbott McNeil Whistler, with whom he briefly studied, and French Impressionist Edgar Degas. Sickert's friends considered him charming and eccentric. He was known to dress in public as different characters, such as a farmer or a tramp. And the first linking of him to the Ripper murders came during the early 1970s when a man named Joseph Sickert claimed he was the artist's illegitimate son. And Joseph Sickert said his father, who died in 1942, would reveal to him the details of the Royal Conspiracy. Well, Walter Sickert, according to the story, played a role in introducing Prince Albert Victor to his commoner wife and later arranged for Mary Jane Kelly to take care of the couple's baby. And Sickert also served as an accomplice to Sir William Gull in carrying out the five initial murders. 1990, English author John Overton Fuller published a book that went a step further and said that Sickert was Jack the Ripper. Fuller had heard stories through her mother, who had gotten information from a friend of Sickert's named Florence Pash, that he was the killer. And Pash said that Sickert told her he knew who Jack the Ripper was, and she had suspicions it was Sickert himself. Well, Sickert, though, seemed to point the finger at Dr. Gull as the instigator. He told Pash he left a clue by including an image of a gull in one of his paintings, though most viewers say they don't see the gull when they look at that painting. Both Pash and Joseph Sickert recounted similar details they said they'd heard directly from Walter Sickert. The son and a friend had never met, so they couldn't have concocted their stories together. And by the time Fuller wrote her book, she was convinced the artist was the killer, and he'd left clues about the killings in some of his paintings. Well, in 2001, The Guardian, a newspaper in London, reported that art experts in England were shocked to hear reports that author Patricia Cornwell had cut up a secret painting to find evidence for her theory. She'd spent more than $2 million to buy some of his art and his letters, apparently to get DNA samples, and she bought his painting table, hoping to find fingerprints. Now, one art dealer dismissed Cornwell's theory as nonsense, saying that Sickert simply liked to play with the idea of menace in his art. Another pointed out that the artist always enjoyed painting scenes of lowlife. Now, for her part, she denied cutting up any of the artwork she purchased, but the rumor still is bandied about. You know, the idea that a respected, if eccentric, British painter could be Jack the Ripper drew the most attention in 2002 with the publication of Patricia Cornwell's Portrait of a Killer. Case closed. Now, she was a best-selling author whose main fictional character, Dr. K. Carspeta, is the chief medical examiner. And her fame helped her get coverage of the book on both BBC and a U.S. Cable network, along with an interview on the New York Times. And like Fuller before, Cornwell became convinced that Sickert gave clues to his role as Jack the Ripper in many of his paintings. And particularly striking to Cornwell was a series of paintings he did after the murder of a prostitute in 1907. It was known as the Camden Town Murder. To Cornwell, the position of the woman's body in the paintings was very similar to the position of Mary Kelly's book after her murder. Or Mary Carey's body, that is, after her murder. The image of that scene had been preserved as a police photo. Now, no one doubted Sickert had always shown an interest in Jack the Ripper and believed the murder was a legitimate subject for art. And he once said, years after the Camden Town paintings, after all, murder's as good a subject as any other. Yeah, but Cornwell wanted to prove her contention by using DNA analysis, and she took DNA samples from the letters supposedly sent to by Jack the Ripper, retrieved from the stamps and envelopes he presumably licked, and she compared them to the samples obtained from Sickert's DNA, which came from envelopes he had licked and had been saved over the years. The results, she said, didn't conclusively prove Sickert was Jack the Ripper, but there was a strong likelihood. Well, critics point out that the letters Cornwell used have not been proven to be from Jack the Ripper. And the form of DNA analyzed, mitochondrial DNA, can be similar among thousands of people. In addition, several historians found evidence that Sickert was in France during the time of at least several of the Whitechapel murders. Well, she tried to support her theory with her second book, Ripper, The Secret Life of Walter Sickert, but she failed to provide concrete evidence to convince most Ripperologists that Sickert was Jack the Ripper. Then, the quest to identify Jack the Ripper took another interesting turn in 2011. And this time an American was the suspect. This man, though, was pretty well known for committing his own murders far from Whitechapel. 2011, attorney Jeff Mudgett published Bloodstains, his account of his family ties to a serial killer by the name of H.H. Holmes, and the link he believes exists between Holmes and Jack the Ripper. Well, when he first learned Holmes was a Mudgett, Holmes was an adopted name, that wasn't his real name. Holmes actually started life as Herman Webster Mudgett, born in a small New Hampshire town of Gilmanton in 1861. Family had deep New England roots and some money, and Mudgett showed intelligence from an early age. But as he regularly wrote in his own confession, he was born with a devil in him, Devil Standing is my sponsor beside the bed where I was ushered into the world. Been with me ever since. Well, Mudgee went on to say he had an early interest in medicine and the use of poisonous gases. Jeff Mudgett later suggested several mysterious drownings of members of the Mudgett family in Gilmanton might have been Herman's doing. And while this is sheer speculation, Herman did admit to carrying out an early mutilation of his son. Mudgett claimed he ordered his young boy to the family barn and cut him up with a surgical knife. Simply the craving of the murderer within me that inspired me to make a subject of my little one. Well, he studied medicine at the University of Michigan, was described alternately as charming and outgoing and a known liar with an obsessive interest in destruction and dissection. During his college years, he carried out various insurance frauds with the help of friends, sometimes using stolen cadavers. Eventually, he became a pharmacist and moved to Chicago, where he soon became embroiled in financial difficulties. And to avoid having to face the music about these financial difficulties, changed his name to H.H. Holmes. In the South Side Chicago neighborhood of Inglewood, he began building a three-story structure in 1887. He'd later called it his murder castle. First floor was retail space, and second floor had apartments, including one that was Holmes' own home. Third floor was added a few years later, and the building, it must be said, had some unusual features. These included a hidden stairway accessible through a trap door on the second floor, and small space between the first and second floors reached through the back of the drugstore. And there were rooms that homes could fill with poisonous gas, and some of the apartments had doors that could be locked only from outside, and chutes ran from the upper floors to the basement, where Holmes eventually installed a large tank he filled with acid. Writing years later, the Chicago Tribune reported that the house's stairways ended nowhere in particular. Winding passages brought the uninitiated with a frightful jerk back to where they'd started. And there were rooms that actually had no doors. And there were doors that had no rooms. Between 1888 and 1885, H.H. Holmes would commit upwards of 20 murders. Many of them were women he swindled, often marrying them, then killing them as well as their family members and absconding with their funds. Others are people that worked for him. Some were locked into soundproof rooms and left to starve. And one victim, he wrote, the door would never be opened until she had ceased to suffer the tortures of slow and lingering death. Several of his victims were killed by deadly gas or poison. Some were assaulted. 1892, plans were underway for the Columbian Exposition to come to Chicago. That was a World's Fair to mark the 400th anniversary of Columbus arriving in the Americas. And the exhibition site was near Inglewood, and Holmes wanted to capitalize on the tourist dollars that would come into the city. So he added a third floor to his building, saying it would be a hotel for visitors. And that claim helped him lure more investors into his world of shady business deals and murderous practices. 1895, a fire at the castle raised suspicious Holmes had set it himself to collect insurance money. And fearing that he would be charged with the arson, he made plans to leave Chicago. And it was after he left the city that an insurance man investigating the fire on the third floor found a footprint on the door to the murder castle vault in which Holmes had locked up a victim. Well, he departed Illinois in 1895, continued to repeat his pattern of marrying unsuspecting women and devising elaborate swindles to collect insurance plans. His travels brought him to Colorado and Texas, where he built a second murder castle in the city of Fort Worth. And it was there that he met up with an old colleague and devised a scheme that would ultimately alert authorities to his crimes. Well, the manhunt for Holmes had kicked off in St. Louis and eventually ended up in Boston, where police finally tracked him down and arrested him. In jail, he confessed only to insurance fraud, but authorities suspected he had committed a whole lot more. Detective Frank Geyer interviewed Holmes after his arrest and later wrote, "Holmes is greatly given to lying with a sort of florid ornamentation. All his stories are decorated with flamboyant draperies intended to by him to strengthen the plausibility of his statements." And news of Holmes' arrest led Chicago police to search the Inglewood murder castle. They found the gas line into a room on the second floor that Holmes could control from his apartment in the building. And in the basement, the police found a vat of acid Holmes used to dissolve bodies. Some bones still lay at the bottom of the tank. The basement also contained large amounts of quicklime, a chemical that can prevent the decay of a dead body. And in the walls of the basement, the investigators found pieces of clothing identifying jewelry and human hair in a pipe connected to a stove. Well, in prison, Holmes began to write his memoir, a book filled with omissions and meant to portray his innocence in the deaths of some of the victims police attributed to him. 1895, he was found guilty of the death of only one known individual, but it was assumed he killed a whole lot more. While waiting for his execution, Holmes gave a confession that, like his memoir, contained both truth and lies. He said he had killed 27 people, and though some of the victims he named were still alive, he received $7,000 from the Philadelphia Inquirer for the confession, which the paper published April 12, 1896. He turned down an offer of more money if he'd allow his body to be used for medical research. It was May 7th. When 1896, when he calmly stepped up to the gallows for his execution, and before the hangman put the noose around his neck, he retracted some of his confession. And some of what H.H. Holmes wrote in his 1895 biography doesn't match known facts. One story rings at least partly true. Given what later took place in Chicago, he claimed that a police officer and a lawyer came to his pharmacy seeking to collect money he owed. Taking an inventory of his stock, the two visitors came upon two barrels and asked what was inside them. Holmes lied and led them to other items in the store. According to Holmes, inside the barrels were remains of the body parts of one of his murder victims. He later tried to burn the barrel, the contents, and the furnace in the basement. The experience was so unpleasant, owing to the terrible odor produced, that he said he didn't think it safe to destroy more in the same way. So he buried the rest of the evidence. And while he lived on 63rd Street, he sometimes hired people to remove trunks or other items from his house. After his deeds became known, some of the men talked about carrying out large, heavy boxes. Historian Albert Selzer suggests some might have been items that the home bought on credit and wanted to sell, or some might have contained the bodies of dead folks. Maybe some of the victims, Holmes later claimed, but authorities couldn't verify in his confession. He told of killing one female boarder whose name he couldn't recall. He claimed that another boarder was in love with the first woman, but when the relationship soured, the man and Holmes worked together to kill her. The body was then carried out of the house in a coffin-shaped box. Well, the question has always come up, was Holmes Jack the Ripper? You know, while the Holmes case was a media sensation in its day, when Jeff Mudgett began immersing himself in the story during the 1990s, the Holmes, Herman Mudgett, was largely forgotten. Jeff was fascinated by the story, though, and couldn't help but compare his ancestors' brutality to that of another infamous killer, Jack the Ripper. He laid out his theory publicly in his book, Bloodstains. He called the book a work of fiction based on fact. Mudgett started his investigation by trying to retrace Holmes' steps on a trip he supposedly took to London in 1888. That was during the time that Jack the Ripper was carrying out his murders. Details of the trip were in a diary Mudgett inherited from his grandfather. And he came up with the idea Holmes had hired and trained an assistant to carry out the Whitechapel killings. Holmes' intent was to draw police and press attention to him while he carried out his real goal, to remove the internal organs of women from better backgrounds than the prostitutes of the East End. Mudgett contended that Holmes had the surgical skill to teach someone else to carry out the mutilations. And when Holmes claimed to have returned to Chicago, the Ripper murder stopped. Some of the witnesses' descriptions of men seen with the victims match Holmes' appearance. And Mudgett admitted his evidence was circumstantial. However, consumed with the idea that his murderous relative could have been Jack the Ripper, he continued to look for evidence to bolster his claim, and he laid out what he learned in a 2014 TED talk. He assumed the role of a prosecutor trying to argue before a grand jury. So was there probable cause to link Holmes and Jack? Well, Mudgett said yes. His arguments included handwriting analysis and showed great similarity between Holmes' writing and the handwriting of the Dear Boss letter. And Mudgett couldn't find any documents or other proof that Holmes was in the U.S. during the Ripper murders. And on that note, we come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll talk a little bit more about connecting to the public in regard to Jack the Ripper. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.